Welcome to Newsworthy with Norisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
Welcome back to the show. Today we are doing our July wrap-up. And so we brought in the big guns, my good friend, Sean Palmer. How you doing, Sean?
Doing well. How are you, Luke?
Good, man. This is, I think, your third time on the show, right?
It is. I'm trying to beat Richard Beck in terms of appearances. So I got a lot of work to do. I need to start writing more, I guess.
You need to, I guess. I mean, he got a shout out yesterday, which I don't know if he really wanted the shout out. So I don't know if that's the lofty goal that you really need to set. You probably need to set a little bit higher.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, I would imagine, to be Richard and to be say, I really respect someone say they really respect you and call you an a-hole.
Yeah. Yeah, I sent him an email last night. I was like, hey, Richard, FYI. Yeah, sorry about that. Hope that makes your day. I haven't heard back from him yet, so we'll see what he says.
But yeah. I thought that was so funny. But you know, in the world of ministry, like, right, we may not hear it all the time, but I'm sure there are people who
think that,
like us and call us a-holes at the same time.
Yeah, that seems to be life for it. And you obviously are no stranger to internet drama and having blogs that incite ruckus crowds on the internet. So you definitely know all about that.
Well, I'm no Richard Beck but these are strongly held beliefs from people, and they react in kind. And so I'm not surprised or shocked when the beliefs are strong.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
I mean, these are things that in a lot of ways, and we're off the Richard Beck conversation specifically right now, but still, when you're trying to describe ways of life and how people think about the world and their worldview, I mean, when we interact with that, I mean, you're interacting with something that has a, you know, deep seated connection to who they are. So
yeah, because things are so deeply held, I mean, you know, you've had the folks that have been on this month. For, you know, McLaren and Jonathan Merritt and Christina Cleveland and Nadia.
Yeah, and Science Mike. Let's not leave Science Mike.
And Science Mike. They have all said things that have made people very upset at different times. And, you know, that's kind of the beauty and the tragedy of the internet and that mode of doing ministry, is that you do get a lot of ideas out there that are very important. But at the same time, you know, it's I think Scott McKnight called it the wild, wild west, right? Everybody's got, all you have to do. When I was talking to him about writing for his Jesus Creed, Stormit was saying something. Oh, Sean's a good writer and all this. And I said, well, basically I have an internet connection, which is all you need to have a voice these days. So, I'm sympathetic to internet controversies. I think it's better. I think I wrote this in a blog post, maybe for Wineskins. I prefer that over the killing of one another, which we've done in the past when we disagreed theologically.
It's a step up. Yeah. Yeah.
It's still pretty ugly.
Yeah. I don't see why. I mean, I get why people want to debate on the internet, and it makes sense to interact with people, especially if that's your only contact. But, I've never been one to sit up at 10:30 at night and argue back and forth with someone on Instagram or Facebook or some blog, but you know, whatever, to each his own.
I don't get the argument. I love that we live in a place and a time where people can kind of put out their ideas, but the kind of back and forth. I mean, you may have saw this yesterday. It broke that, you know, these back in the past 10 or 15 years ago with Mark Driscoll going on the online forums for Mars Hills Church with a pseudonym and kind of blasting people. And like, that seems like a waste of time and energy to me.
I saw that. Is it conclusively Driscoll? I mean, I know the story is that in a book he writes, hey, I used to write as William Wallace on a forum. And then they go back 10, 15 years and they find history of this William Wallace figure. And there's no loose ends. That's completely him. There's no way to say that's not him.
I don't know 100% whether that's him and there are no loose ends, but, that's the story right now. We'll see. Hopefully it's not, you know, you would hate to think that someone in a church leadership role would be not only so insecure as to do that, but I mean, it's just kind of nasty and vehement. Like the stuff that he says, like if someone were at your church saying those things to other members of your church, you and the other leaders in your congregation would have a serious conversation with that person about not only speech ethics, but a whole bunch of other stuff. It comes, if it really is him, it does appear to come from a pretty dark heart.
At some point, the internet has turned so much against Driscoll that, you know, making pot shots about, you know, the big influential, powerful spokesman of Christianity seems at some point to be like, now you're just dumping on someone who everyone else is dumping on. And I don't really know what to say about it. He's fascinating, interesting, but it's a heartbreaking story. And you know what else?
There's a guy I'm friends with on Facebook, and he's kind of a national leader. He's not extraordinarily well known, but like every day he's got a new post about Driscoll, and it's like, dude, you're obsessed. Like, go get a cheeseburger or something. Yes. Like, just relax.
Yes. You know what you know what he should do? He should be watching Preachers of L.A.
Be watching Preachers of L.A. Now, and he should do a Preachers of L.A. podcast.
Now, Sean,
many times.
You've been on vacation for, you know, a week and a half, so you might have missed it. But last Wednesday, something showed up in my DVR. It was the Preachers of L.A., like, end of season one man chat or something. Did you see that?
I didn't see it. I hadn't watched any television probably in about 2.5 or 3 weeks.
Yeah. Or is that, like, I am more holy than you. I haven't watched TV in 2 or 3 weeks. Or is that you're just on vacation?
I've just been behind a wheel of a car.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
Nothing holy.
Well, if people don't know, Sean and I have this fascination with the reality show Preachers of LA, which is on like Oxygen or something like that. And in a lot of it, it's just a big train wreck. And it's, it really is. And I hope
there are these key moments of redemption, though, every now and then. It's like every episode and a half where something happens and you go, like, okay, that's real. Like, that's a real thing. And it's like every reality show. It's kind of set up like, what's her name when they reveal that she's pregnant, you know, at the end of the season, last season. Like, if you're watching that show pretty carefully, you can already tell that she's pregnant. Like, when you see her, she looks pregnant, you know. And, like, there's some that, I mean, honestly, there's some moments of it that are truly sad. Like, the guy who's probably... I can't remember his name now. It's been so long since I've watched the show, but he's got the boys and the wife and the big, huge house.
Bishop McClendon.
Yes. And he's talking with his son about leading worship, and they have this dialogue. I don't know if you remember this, about how he really wanted to be a musician, but his dad really wanted him to be a pastor. So he became a pastor, and he's kind of using all of his success now. Like, he's got his son in the recording studio, which costs tons to have recording studio time and doing all that. And you go, man, like that, like of all of his life, that was the most real moment to me, because like I'm saying, like this happens, you know, my dad wanted me to become a dentist or a doctor or, you know, take over the family store. And that's what I did. And I passed up on the thing that I really wanted to do. And I want to make that available to you. Like that, there are these little snapshots of humanity that happen that I think the show becomes compelling, but then between those, it's a hilarious train wreck.
It is heartbreaking. Well, before we go down this rant too long, let's get back to the July wrap up stuff.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, so, if you didn't know, Jonathan Mayer was our first guest, and, he talked about some of the Hobby Lobby stuff. He mentioned some of his book stuff, but, the interesting thing is you grew up right around, the Merritt family in Georgia.
Yeah, they were probably about 30 minutes from where I live in Stone Mountain. If you live in Atlanta, everything's 30 minutes. Like, that's what you tell, no matter where it is. It could be 15 minutes. It could be 45. His dad, James, took over, I want to say, Snellville First Baptist, maybe, or...
Okay.
It was a sizable church, but very traditional Southern Baptist church. And, you know, his dad at one point was president of Southern Baptist. A convention, and he was on television. It was very buttoned down Baptist stereotypical church.
Okay.
And what happened after he took over was this huge shift, not theologically, but in terms of practice. And so now if you see him on television, I think the show is called Touching Lives. His show is called Touching Lives. It looks very, community church. He doesn't wear the suit anymore. It's got this band and big, huge lights. But what's hilarious about that to me is his preaching style is exactly the same.
Is it really?
Yeah, like so the decorations, like the ornamentage, has changed, but the message and his preaching style is exactly the same. But what I found interesting about that is clearly his dad is someone who can make things happen. Hmm. He's very type A and driven. You don't become the leader of the Southern Baptist Convention. You don't change a church like that from where it was to where they are now without having a certain set of leadership skills. And so then kind of Jonathan grows out of that. And the interesting conversation about that, what I found most interesting was when he was talking about his parents reading his book.
Yeah.
And every parent in the world has that. Every parent in the world knows, okay, what is it that I'm doing that's going to land my child on the therapist couch? Like, I know what it is. I know that it's going to happen. I just don't know what it is because I wouldn't do it.
Yeah. If you knew what it was, you'd stop it.
But
that's a tough balance. I mean, I say that as I'm looking at a picture of my three daughters right next to me, you know, the screen on my desk. I'm going, how am I screwing you three little girls up? I don't know. But in some ways it's like, isn't that part of the social contract we all signed to be human? Like when you're around people, you're eventually going to let them down. That's just part of being a human. And okay, all of us parents can think, what am I doing that's going to screw up my kid? But what interaction do you have with someone in which your own frailty and your brokenness isn't revealed? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's almost like, if you want to pick apart any friendship, any relationship, anytime you rely upon someone, they're going to let you down because that's just part of people. We're imperfect. And
yeah, but you know, the thing with kids is when a kid comes into the world, they're completely dependent upon you.
Yeah.
And part of that dependence is like, oh, this woman, this man, they know everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they know when I need to go down for a nap. They know what this cry means. And like slowly over time, you realize that your parents don't know everything and they're not right about everything.
Yeah.
And there's a grieving that comes with that. And that grieving is called adolescence. And I'm going back into old youth minister mode here.
Oh, no. Let's go to Six Flags next. Oh, yeah. What? Yeah, no, I get that. I get that. And so maybe, you know, that does have to happen. But the conversation, which obviously Jonathan, I think, had a therapist who told me I need to do this. So the guy's probably more trained or the girl's more trained than I am. But,
sure.
You know, my dad listens to podcasts. And so I was talking to him about it afterwards. And, I said, you know, for me, I've never had the desire to go up to my dad and say, hey, this is how you failed me. You know, I've never had that. I know that my dad is just as imperfect as I am as a father. But I've never had the feeling like I need to get this off my chest. And my dad is a psychologist. And so part of what he does is helps people make peace with situations that aren't available for them to have this sort of reconciliation. Because how do you make peace with a parent who's passed away? How do you make peace with a parent who is not emotionally present for you to be able to do that? And so it's a tough balance, but it was really fascinating. And that was a similar question that I wanted to ask Nadia is, okay, you dumped a lot on your religious heritage. But your parents are still a part of that. And so how did they respond to it? And we didn't get to talk about it, but it's fascinating to me.
Well, can I tell you something about the parent thing? It's probably one of the best things that's ever happened to me. Because like you said, every parent fails. And, you know, Jonathan has had his own arc and he's been the source of his own internet, you know, driven controversies and things. And he seemed to move past those pretty healthily. But here's a fabulous thing that my mother did. For me is, and it wasn't long ago. I mean, it's been within this calendar year or she called me up and she said, would you tell me, how I failed you
really?
As a mother? Yeah.
And you answered her? I don't want specifics, but let's gossip about Mrs. Palmer. No, but, yeah. But you answered her and gave her.
No, but the thing is when parents do that, at least this is what happened to me. Like there's just something that releases in a child. And I looked at I look at my life and I look at my wife and my two girls and, you know, I'm sitting here looking at the mountains of Colorado and the church that I serve and the opportunities I've had. And like, I know that she wasn't perfect, but when I look at what she produced for me and my brother, like I wrote about, I said, you did not fail, you know, and that's the big picture. And so like with our girls, I think Rochelle and I are very quick to say, like, oh, like, mommy shouldn't have done that. Mostly mommy, but daddy shouldn't have. Yeah. You know, daddy shouldn't have done that. Daddy didn't say that the right way. Or like, we tell you not to do this, and then we did it, and that was wrong.
Yeah.
Or we're sorry. And we're kind of, I hope that we're doing some things that let them know, like we are real and good and bad, but we're committed to you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My wife tells stories about her dad coming up and apologizing to her when she was a little girl, and she remembers those stories some 20 years later. And I mean, that's a very powerful thing that a parent can do. So I think it's, you know, a great thing for every parent to try to work towards.
And I think a lot of counterintuitive things about parenting, we'll talk about that later, but I think consistency is good, but I think it's overrated.
Okay, let's go. I'll go down the rabbit trail with you. How is consistency overrated?
Because life requires life requires discernment, constant discernment, and there are no two situations that are exactly the same. And so you're making decisions. I don't want to lock myself into a set of rules for every decision. That if I were discerning, listening to the situation, listening to the Holy Spirit, that I might make differently. So everybody acknowledges that their children are very different from each other. So what does consistency look like when you know that the personalities are different? You really can't. And I want to teach the girls to be discerning people, not just rule followers.
Yeah.
I mean, rule following makes for a very difficult life when discernment opens you up to the move of the Spirit.
Yeah.
So I would rather say, you know, we're going to have to think and pray about this. And make a decision versus, well, you know, we made up these rules 10 years ago. And you know, we're on vacation. Well, we've made a rule that you can only have this kind of snack, you know, at 3 o'clock. Well, shoot, we're on vacation.
Yeah.
Let's go to the crepe stand.
Yeah. That's kind of like, you know, phase two parenting. Your daughters are older than mine. My oldest is about 6 in a few weeks, and yours are, 10-ish or so?
10 and 7.
Yeah, 10 and 7. And so, like, it seems like phase one parenting, one of the most important things is if you say something, you're going to do it. And if you create a rule, you follow it. But then, like you're saying, you've got to eventually move out of that and to be able to make wise, discerned decisions.
Oh, yeah. If you create a rule, you need to follow it. Yeah. So my tack is just not to create a rule.
Gosh, that is one of the worst things I do as a parent is one of my daughters will say something. I say, no, we're not going to do that tonight. And then I go, why did I say that? I don't need to say that. Let them do whatever they want right now. This is not a big deal. And then I have to hold to it and there's a fight. Yes, that's a great suggestion.
Yeah. That'll give some other people, that'll give people plenty to talk about, I guess.
Yeah. We'll let them talk
but
about that.
I was really interested this last month in your conversation with Christina.
Yeah. Yeah. I was looking forward to that podcast. I was looking forward to all of these. And I really enjoyed talking with her. But, okay, so like the whole time when I do most interviews, like I am playfully able to like take on the devil's advocate role. And so if I'm, you know, talking to someone about, you know, treating women equally as men, I'm fine to be like the sexist guy and kind of make jokes that direction to spark the conversation. Like I'm fine to do that. Like I'm fine to play the, you know, the heel in the conversation. I'm fine with that. But when it comes to like racial issues, I'm telling myself the whole time, Luke, don't sound racist. Don't sound racist. Yeah. Don't sound racist. And also don't quote Macklemore. Cause that would be just, you know, too white, you know? And so there's like this trepidation I have of, I'm really interested in the material, but I don't know why, but I'm sensitive to, I don't want to be the ignorant white guy who's not concerned about the plight of people who have had different experiences because of their racial and their ethnicity.
Yeah. The thing is I've spent so much of my life around and in white cultures and with white folks, I get where you're coming from on that. Cause the worst thing I feel like, especially for people who want to do the right thing,
the like worst me, thing like in our me. Culture,
like you, Luke,
thank you.
Is being called a racist, right?
You think that's the worst thing to be called?
I think that's, I mean, if you just go up to like, the force at which my white friends respond to the suggestion that they are racist, it's stronger than being called feminist. it's stronger than being called, you know.
Yeah, progressive, liberal, conservative. Yeah, yeah. That like, makes sense.
If you call somebody a racist, then, like, there's something about that that sparks in my white friends that is different. That I don't know if I can put my finger on it, but it's different from what I
You think it's like white guilt? Like that, okay, we know... I think this is a Louis C.K. bit, though. Like, we know being white is great. Like, you go any time period in a time machine, and it's great to be white. But we know eventually we're going to get what we deserve. Like, that we've eventually go. And I've heard people say that that's the white American fascination with Dr. King, is that he is the African-American leader who we know is giving us a good break. Instead of giving, in some ways, giving us the retribution we deserve, he is this angel who has given us forgiveness and grace, and we all want that because we know that we deserve punishment for mistreatment of other people.
Yeah, but, you know, they didn't give it to him at the time.
Oh, yeah.
But here's the interesting thing. I mean, King's approach to his white, what he would call his white brothers and sisters, was like, we have got to mitigate the anxiety in white people that if blacks are allowed equal footing, if minorities are allowed equal footing in the culture, that we will retaliate. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And for King, that was the baseline fear of white folks, is that we would, that black people would return the injustices on whites that had been visited on them. And he didn't just make that up. And you go back and you read biographies of Washington or Jefferson, I've done this, you know, this year, even as far down as Lincoln, and the baseline fear for ending slavery, and the baseline fear for the people who objected to slaves being introduced into the military during the Revolution, Civil War, is if we arm these guys, there's going to be a slave revolt.
Of course, yeah.
And so from the beginning of the history of the country, the fear in whites has been, once these people are empowered, they will do to us what we have done to them.
Yeah, definitely.
And so what King came along and said, we're not going to do that. You know, as part of the rule of life for the civil rights movement, that it's going to be nonviolent. And so that's why people were able to, that's why some whites at least were able to gravitate to it, because they said, oh, that's maybe not going to happen.
Yeah.
But, you know, every time someone, and I love Christina, I love her work. I was really honored she included me on this list of bloggers that she thought were worth reading.
You got a shout out from her? Look at you.
Oh, yeah. You know, we all know each other. That's basically the bottom line.
See, I can't make a joke about that. I would definitely jump on that, but I can't make a joke about that.
You know, so when, you know, she wrote that piece, I think probably about the same time you interviewed her, about the voice of, you know, kind of the white guy on a board, or, you know, that the,
yeah.
The, and I read that and I thought, well, this is going to make, like, if you're a white man or woman and you want to be helpful in this discussion and in this movement, and what's your role? Because, you don't want to come across as the person who is trying to dominate and domineer the discussion, because that's exactly the thing that we're trying to get away from. But what do you do? Just kind of sit there? That goes back to sort of that idea, kind of goes back to something very Malcolm X, that there's no role for any white people in this. And so it places my white friends, I think, in a precarious position to want to do something, but to do it in a way. And I think the only thing that people can do is show up as themselves. I just think that's kind of basically my rule of life.
What do you mean by, like, show up by as themselves? Okay, I'm a white man. I care about people being treated equally. What does it mean to show up as myself?
I'll give you an example. My good friend and former college roommate, Chad Higgins, his oldest daughter, who is an incredible kid, was born with dwarfism. Forgive me, because I forget the precise medical name of it. And we were having lunch in Houston the day that he told me, you know, she hadn't been born yet. She was still in the womb. And I said to Chad, you know, something along these lines. I said, okay, I don't know very much about this, but I'm curious, and I'm going to ask you this, some questions, and please forgive me if I say something stupid.
Hmm.
Right. or if I say something insensitive, yeah. and because I don't mean to. Okay, so that only works because we have a history together. Mm-hmm. And Christina pointed to this in the podcast, which I thought was really great. Like, I always think the best reconciliation work, the best things to move people ahead, to move any conversation ahead, is to do the relational work when the gun's not loaded.
Yeah, exactly. That was brilliant. I think she's 100% right about that.
And so, okay, if I really want to be helpful, I mean, the best thing that a lot of my white friends could do in racial relation conversations is get to know the Hispanic or the African American, or if you've got a high constituency of Asian Americans in your community, get to know the pastors of those churches, mm-hmm. and find things to do together. Start with a pulpit swap. Start with, you know, potluck or whatever it is. Let's do a you know, we're going to clean up the local park for the kids, to build relationships. Mm-hmm. Because when you boil it down, the problem exists because we don't know each other, right? So only people who don't know 17-year-old black kids thought that Trayvon Martin was a thug, you know? Like, if you say, oh, he's the age of, you know, Carl and Jenny's son, and I've seen him in our small group, and he walks around with hoodies, like, is that what I want for him?
Yeah.
Like, when you know people, that changes everything. And most of us, the only place that we're not, the only place we can choose who we want to be around in American society today is church. And most of the time we choose people who look, talk, and act just like us.
Okay, hold on. Let's go. That's a pretty powerful statement there. That's the only time we really get to choose the people we're around.
Yep. Yeah. You can't choose who buys the house next door.
No.
You can't choose who works at the...
works with
in
you.
In the cubicle, yeah. You know, next to yours, or who's on the staff with you at work. Can't choose who you run into at the grocery store. Mm-hmm. Can't choose any of that anymore.
But church is one of the...
But church is the one place left that you can choose who you want to be around. Mm-hmm. And I think our choice is very revealing.
Yeah. Okay, so here's the situation I threw to Christine to begin the conversation was, say there's a university that has made some decisions on, you know, gender issues. And so they've decided we're going to include women in the same capacity as men. But in return, the downside of that is that you have created tension between the university and African-American churches of the same fellowship, because the African-American churches typically are not going that direction in this specific denomination. Mm-hmm. And so I asked her, well, what do you do if you're going to have to sacrifice treating women equally, or you're treating the African-American churches in your denomination equally? What do you do? And if you remember her answer, it was, well, sometimes you have to walk away from it, and sometimes you can't fix it. And I thought that was a really wise statement, because you're not going to please everyone. And at some point, you have to realize that you can't make every relationship work.
Yeah. That's tough, because that's true of the denomination that we both come from, right?
So I always say that hypothetically, but I'm assuming people are going to connect the dots and realize he's not just making this up out of the blue, but yeah.
Yeah. Here's my basic philosophy on relational issues, is that you say yes where you can say yes. Mm-hmm. And I think if everybody did that, we'd have a much better world. Say, okay, so you're not going to go along with us on women's issues. Is there a contact point where we can still be partners? Is that a complete deal breaker for you? And if it is, I want you to know my door is always open. Like, one of the things that Rochelle and I in relationships, especially with each other, when there's tension, is that we place a high value on taking a step toward one another. Mm-hmm. So, and we will say that, like, so there's a disagreement about something, and we'll say, okay, I'm going to take a step toward you here. Mm-hmm. And can we at least get this far together?
Yeah.
And those acts really do begin to add up. And some of those, what you're asking is the basic issue that we keep dealing with in society. You know, what's worse, you know, the racial problem or the feminine question?
Yeah.
And, you know, who's got it worse? Is Barack or Hillary? You know, that kind of back and forth question. And I don't think that there's, I don't think there is a satisfying answer for anybody in that. So you just have to say yes where you can say yes.
Yep.
And if everything's a deal breaker, then nothing's all that important. And you say, you know, for our movement right now, this over here might be more important than this over here for X, Y, and Z, or they're both equally important and we're going to do as much as we can and go as far as we can with each other.
Yep.
But then you do get to a point ultimately where, just like every relationship, to say, to salvage the relationship, then we have to create some distance.
Yep.
And there is a, there's biblical precedent for that, right? Say, you know what, to salvage the relationship, then we might not be able to work together this closely. But that doesn't preclude any chance of working together in the future.
Yeah. What is Paul's line about, live at peace with as far as yours can control or something. Obviously I don't have the quote down, but yeah, I mean, that's something that we need to try to live out. That's great. Okay. Now let's change gears. Let's talk about Brian McLaren. Now I really need to say thanks, first of all, because you were the one who introduced me and Brian. So first of all, kudos to you for being a kind friend and setting that email friendship up. So thank you for that. have you already read that, his new book?
I had. I got the advanced copy.
Ooh, the ARC.
Probably at the beginning. Yes. So I got that and read through it. And it was, it's really different from Brian. Here's the great thing about Brian. One, the two things. One, he really is one of the more generous people that I've ever known in my life. I mean, setting up that interview with him was pretty simple, right? I mean,
it was an email. Yeah. I mean, I've had a lot of people very generous, but yeah, he was very generous and very easy to talk to, obviously.
And once you're his friend, you are kind of his friend for life. Like mm-hmm. That's, I think, the way he sees it. And he's, so he's just very generous in all aspects. And two, most of his books, as much controversy and flack as he takes, I think the majority of his books are about spiritual formation. Mm-hmm. If you were to take off the table, just a few titles that kind of got people twisted, you'd say, oh, this guy really, the heart of his message is about how churches and people are spiritually formed. Yeah. And I think that's what he's trying to do. I think that's where Brian's heart is in spiritual formation. I think to do it the way that he's done it requires a level of deconstruction and reconstruction. I know you guys talked about the concept of, views of God and you having to let go of some views of God in order to embrace higher views of God.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that was a line he had from a blog somewhere else. I think it was on Rachel Ott Evans' blog. They talked about that.
Yeah. And I think that's what Brian really is after ultimately, is that people have kind of growing vibrant relationship with God in ways that are meaningful. Mm-hmm. But to do that, we've got to get out of these. We've got to get out of answering 16th century questions for some people, you and I both know the Bible only exists. Just really Romans is the only Bible you need to answer 16th century questions from a couple of dudes who are really interested in those particular questions.
Yeah.
And I think Brian's done a good job of that. And he's also wanting to just do work for churches. Like, we make the road by walking. That's just a book for the church, a book for pastors. Say, you know what? It's hard out there. He was a pastor for 24 years. There are some times you need to focus on some other things. It's sort of a 21st century lectionary.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
Here's something, hand it to you. You can do this in small groups. You can do this as your sermons for a year or a period of time, because one of the things they're doing more of it now that people my age didn't get in seminary was any sort of training in spiritual formation. I had one class taught by a fabulous professor, changed the way I do ministry. And I was thinking, what if spiritual formation were at the heart of, like an eighth, a fourth of my,
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting stuff that he's working on. And I think that resource he's creating for the church, which I think it's really important to say. I mean, he's doing this for the church, and for as much as he talked about new kind of Christianity and, you know, new concepts of God, he's not trying to say get rid of church altogether. He's trying to say, no, this is something that the church can use. And I really appreciate his commitment to the church, which is great. But you can't really talk about Brian McLaren without talking about the book A New Kind of Christian. Like, if his life story is written up, the first paragraph is Brian McLaren born such and such, and the second paragraph is A New Kind of Christian.
Kind of Christian, yeah. And it was the first book I read of his.
That's the first book I read of his as well. It was probably, you know, early 2000s. I was probably in grad school at the time, and I remember reading going, wow, this is amazing. And the fascinating thing to me is I never knew this, but he originally wrote the first part of that book as a typical nonfiction book. And then
I didn't know that till you talked to him.
Yeah. And then he said, no, I realized that had turned into fiction. And it's fascinating that, like, that book would not have been the sort of influential text that it has been for many people if it's nonfiction.
Yeah.
Fiction makes it work.
It would have been too on the nose.
Yeah. Which is fascinating because you think about how much of Jesus's message is told through fiction. Obviously, it's called parables when Jesus does it, but it's called fiction when McLaren does it. But it shapes the way that you understand theology and God, because when you're just giving this sort of didactic, here's one point, here's 2 points, here are 3 points, you don't experience it the same way that you do a story. And I think that's, like, really the success of that book was his ability to create a story out of it.
Yeah, and I, you know, I'm here in Colorado with my friend Russ, and he was the one that first introduced me to Brian McLaren. And I was at a crucial point in my ministry life when I read A New Kind of Christian, not very different from the character in that book. And I don't think it would have had the same kind of resonance with me had it been, you know, the standard off the Christian bookstore shelf, you know, sort of thing. But you at least for me, I saw, if not myself, I saw a lot of people that I knew in that story, and I could see how that could easily happen. And A New Kind of Christian probably shaped a generation, I think, of pastors in a particular way that was really helpful. So again, I didn't know that had started out as a nonfiction book, but I'm glad he went the way.
Is there a cat being tortured in your room?
No, there's a 10-month-old. Maybe he'll crawl over here and we can introduce him to the world.
Do you have a 10-month-old and you didn't tell me?
No,
Sean?
my friend Russ, who's here, and his wife have a 10-month-old.
Outstanding. I didn't even know. I would have been really disappointed if you had a child and didn't tell me about it.
No, we're done as far as I know.
Okay. Yeah, well, obviously, you know, McLaren stuff is very fascinating, and his conversation about gatekeepers, because that's something that he deals with a lot, is that you have the guys who are saying, or the girls who are saying, Brian, you said this, so you're no longer included. You're out.
Yeah.
You're farewell, Brian, because you wrote this. And he had a really fascinating take on it, which leans heavily on you know, the social science, that the basic idea of a gatekeeper is it creates group identity by knowing who you're against, which is just group dynamics 101. If you have a common enemy, then you can rally together and have a community.
Yeah, I think that's why we're going to see Luke. And I hope this isn't just wishful thinking, but I think in the next 20 years that some of the more influential churches in America are going to be between 50 and 200 people.
Why do you think that?
Because let me see if I can say this the right way without offending people who I really love. I think the megachurch movement, when our historical denomination, yours and mine, just don't have real megachurches. We have some really large ones who are kind of at the foothills of megachurch. I think a great bit of that is about group identity. That's not necessarily rooted in the gospel, but if you will just notice from history, movements that are about openness and embracing other people, about welcoming the stranger, groups that are about healing, the only time that they get big but still remain small, there's no AA meeting with 4,000 people, right? There are just a lot of them. And my hope is that before I die, that we see less Walmarts and more Dollar Generals in terms of churches. Like, they're everywhere, but they're serving this small group of people, because of the nature of the thing, can't allow it to be extraordinarily big.
So you think that the gatekeeper mentality ties into the megachurch movement?
Absolutely.
Huh.
I think part of the megachurch movement is this idea of, look at the megachurches. How many megachurches? I mean, Lakewood and Houston with Joel is maybe the outlier, but not that much. How many of those are majority same culture, majority same socioeconomics, majority of the same background? Like, it's just a club is too incendiary. I don't want to say that they're just a big club of the same people. But it is really hard to be in community with people who aren't like you.
And you think if you're going to the mega church, you can find community in mega churches. I'm not saying you can't.
Sure.
But on a Sunday morning, you're going to be sitting around a lot of people you probably don't know. And so if you're going to show up there, you want to sit around people you don't know, but have a lot of similarities to.
Yeah, that you do know implicitly because they are so much like you. Right.
Huh.
Like, I don't know you, but I mean, and this is marketing 101. This is, like, you carve out, just watch your next sport or your next television show that you're really into, watch the commercials. Those are targeted for you and people who are like you. There are a lot of Viagra commercials during golf tournaments.
Yeah, that right? makes, yeah.
Because it's a bunch of old dudes who watch golf tournaments. And I think church in the last 20 years has really capitalized on that and said, you know what, we can do the same thing. We can target a market and create an experience that is suitable and useful for that market. I'm not saying that's all bad.
Yeah.
I'm just, in my view, when you're talking about ministry of reconciliation and welcome to the stranger, which I find core to the gospel, that the very first thing that Jesus does is come to a people who are not like him. I find that there is some gospel absence in creating churches deliberately to focus on people who aren't strangers and who are just like you.
Interesting. Well, before I get clumped into the anti-mega church group that Sean Palmer has clearly made himself the president of, let me just say, I'm not
anti-mega church.
Okay. Now, but there is an interesting dynamic there, and I think welcoming the stranger is an interesting component that I think it's very difficult when you're around a bunch of people you don't know every Sunday morning. But like I said, I love mega churches, especially the ones that helped me plant my church. So I love you, everyone else. Hey,
like I said, though, our movement doesn't have a lot of mega churches. And I mean,
the ones we do have are the ones who helped me start my church. So I'm going to say this.
And those are great churches.
Yeah. No, but as a general rule, I think it is a very fascinating discussion to have.
Here's the thing. Here's the reason I know that I'm not talking about our churches, because we don't know anything about branding and marketing. that is really antithetical to who we are as a movement. The idea of marketing and branding and targeting. That's one of the reasons we don't have very many mega churches, because we're just not very. It just doesn't sit well with us.
Yeah. And if you don't know, Sean Palmer is from the Churches of Christ, and that's the church he's a part of is connected to the Churches of Christ, and that's the tradition he is talking about. So just a little FYI to people who are listening. Okay, so let's change gears. Science Mike, the next podcast. Really fascinating guy. Had you ever interacted with any of his material before the podcast?
I hadn't. It's totally new to me. I dialed up his TED Talk. No, he talked about Jonathan Haidt's book, right?
Yeah, that's...
And so I dialed up Jonathan Haidt's TED Talk and kind of watched it a little bit. What I thought was interesting about Mike, well, you tell me what you thought about him as kind of interviewing. Why was he a target for you?
You know, it's interesting. I listen to the comedian Pete Holmes podcast every once in a while, and he's a comedian, usually interviews comedians, and so it's an interesting conversation usually. But he had Science Mike on there one time, and I didn't really know who this guy was, and so I'm out, you know, grilling some chicken or something, and this is the first podcast that came on when I turned on my, you know, podcast app. And so I started listening to it, and it's a really, really interesting story. He told some of it in the podcast that we did, where you have this guy who is very analytical and very rational, and he has this mystical experience that transforms his belief set from being, okay, I don't know if God is out there, to saying, okay, God, you're out there and I believe you. And that was fascinating because his whole life, you know, the whole story up until that point was you can't prove this and you can't prove that and you can't prove this and you can't prove that. But he has this mystical experience and then he has faith, which I really appreciate his brutal honesty because in some ways he kind of gets out of character. I mean, his character, his moniker is Science Mike. So he has to be this kind of analytical guy, but he says, I'm a human. So I make decisions that aren't that are always analytical. Yeah. And that's where I brought up Jonathan Haidt stuff, because if you don't know Jonathan Haidt, he's a psychologist at a UVA, and I think he's a moral psychologist. And I hopefully I'm going to get him on when his next book comes out in a few months. But we interact with his material, and you come to the idea that people don't make logical decisions. Instead, you follow your passions, and he builds a lot off the work of Hume. And so there are like three typical positions about how people make choices. And so like Aristotle says, you know, we're logical creatures and we make the decisions that are most logical. Well, Ben Franklin, who is the founder of the University of Virginia, where Jonathan Haidt works, says, no, we're half and half. It's like half passion, half reason. And Haidt says, no, it's all passions. It's all our feelings, all of our emotions. And then our brain, in a lot of ways, is the press secretary explaining why we're doing this decision.
Sure.
And so you've got the Science Mike guy who is very logical, reasonable, analytical. He has this mystical experience, and all of a sudden his brain is having to say, okay, this is why we do it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah. What I found fascinating about that is because living in the church world, I've come across so many people whose arguments for things have been very reasoned and analytical, they say. And they say, but if you listen to them talk long enough, you will hear how much emotional, much emotional baggage they have put into the idea that they see themselves as a intellectual, reasonable person, right? So, like, it's like, well, this just doesn't make any sense. And here's the thing: but if you listen closely enough, you say, "Oh, like you, there's something emotive in you about being that kind of person." You get emotional satisfaction out of being a kind of person who sees themselves as going for the best reason.
Yeah, and Haidt would say that's also connected to group dynamics. That part of it is that I'm in this group, and this is how the group thinks, and so I want to be a part of this group. And so he says we don't vote individualistically. Like, issue is more money for military. Say you come from a political circle in which you don't want to support the military with more finances, even though your son is in the military. You're going to pick not what's best for you individually, but what's best for your group, because that's a lot of ways how we understand who we are. And so that's a decision we make, and then therefore we go back and rationalize it afterwards.
Yeah. I think that's, you know, I'm not a science guy.
You're not science Sean?
I'm not science Sean. I'm far from it. But yeah, from what I have experienced, I would say that there's something there. There's something, people vote against their interest.
Yeah, that's what he's saying, yeah.
People who make choices. I mean, we all make choices that are emotional choices, from over-shopping to overeating to under-eating to under-saving. Over-saving, that are based on values. Like, I would say that most folks have a set of deeply held values that are connected to groups, that are connected to identity, that they make decisions out of, whether it's the best decision in that case. But that goes back to the whole thing about creating rules versus discernment started talking about. Like, if you make a decision to discern more than decide, that's a fundamental decision in life that changes the way you go about doing things.
Okay, explain that.
Let's kind of tie several examples that we use together. Let's say a university discerns that they need to make some changes in accordance with their will, what they feel like is God's will. Acts 15, it seemed good to the Holy Spirit and us. And they make a decision about women's roles at a large university gathering, right? They've discerned that that is the right thing to do. But they might decide against it because a large constituency of the people they serve would be against it, and that might be detrimental to their funding base.
Yeah.
Now, if you make a decision If you've made a decision that we've always got to be this much in the black as a university to feel good, then that will lead you to make one decision. But if you made a decision, if you made the decision to discern, then that leads you to another decision. Mm-hmm. And I think discerned decisions are almost always better than decided decisions. To say, like, we've actually spent time in the Word and with God about this in a number of different ways, in a number of different areas, from a number of different people. And this is what seems right to us. And there's no, you know, I've never understood the hesitance of people to say no decision is our last. That we may discern, we may think this is what God wills, and it turns out that we were wrong. Yeah. And so we'll change it. But a discerning culture is very much different from a deciding culture. And what most of our congregations have is a deciding culture. So that means an issue gets put on the table. We'll order some books. The elders will study it. We'll get the church to study it, maybe call in an expert to talk about it. And then we'll kind of put the plus column here and the minus column here, and then we'll decide. And there's nothing wrong with any of those things. Mm-hmm. But there is, if you don't say what we're going to do, a discerning process would be, we're going to seek God in prayer for such and such time. Yeah. And then we're going to do this, that, and we're going to, you know, we're going to bathe this whole process in spiritual practices and spiritual disciplines. And we're going to study. Our study is going to be a factor in what we do.
Yeah.
But it's not going to drive the process.
Yeah.
Because that's saying we just want to make a decision. Mm-hmm. And then once decisions are made, it's very different to go to a congregation and say the elders come back with a decision than to say we're going to invite this entire congregation into a process to discern where we go next. Yeah. And every voice is going to be equal. And we're going to call you, you know, don't show up for the meeting. Don't show up for the meeting when we're going to have the expert here talking about it. If you haven't been here on the Wednesday nights or whatever, when we've gathered to pray about it.
Yeah. It seems like the piece that this understanding of, okay, we aren't these logical, rational creatures we want ourselves to be. I think the piece of what that brings to us is humility. Like, okay, we need to be humble enough to say, we might not have it right, and that's okay.
Yeah.
And we're just going to apply the best that we can with what we do have. And so it's not like it's a cop-out to say, well, we can't get it right, so we're just going to pick whatever we want. But it's a piece to say, I'm going to do this decision in humility, and we're going to discern the best way we can. But ultimately, there's a lot going on behind closed doors of our brains that we don't understand.
Yeah. And when we started The Vine, one of the first series I preached through was the book of Acts. And the whole impetus behind that was I wanted to get to Acts 15, to the Jerusalem Council at Acts 15, because those are some heavy issues. And what you find there in Acts 15 is James, the brother of Jesus, gets up and says, look, we're going to have as few rules as possible. we're going to have as few rules as possible. And then we're just going to have to discern everything else. And we're going to have to let Paul go and do Paul's thing in Paul's way, as long as he's keeping to these few rules. Yeah. And then I'm going to hang here in Jerusalem and do some other stuff. And we're going to send some people to some other areas, and they're going to do stuff in their way that works best there.
Yeah, that's good. So, well, speaking of other church plants, let's talk about a Lutheran church planner that I just interviewed yesterday, Miss Nani Bowles Weber. Did you get a chance to listen to that? I know you're on vacation.
I did, and I was I was really, you know, I read her book, and I listened to it early this morning, listened to her podcast of that. And what I found so interesting is, you and I've talked about this before, is that I don't think people in the beginning know how to take you, because they've been doing these interviews with, like, national magazines and, you know, podcasts mm-hmm. for, you know, PBS.
Oh, you're saying
whatever.
Me specifically, yeah, like you, Luke. Okay. Luke. All right,
they don't know how to take you. Uh-huh. And so they come across, even Nadia, you know, comes across very formal. And you say, hello, Nadia. And she says, hi, Luke. And it's very formal. But then you mentioned CrossFit. And, like, it was like she, you know, it was like a butterfly getting her wings. Like, she was just like,
yeah.
She became so much more animated when you mentioned CrossFit, and it was just like off to the races. And you're always talking about WODs and girls' yeah. names for workouts. And,
yeah.
And she said at the beginning, and I know this feeling because I could do the same with Beachbody stuff. Like, I could just do the whole podcast about that.
Yeah.
And,
well, yeah, I've always wanted these to be conversations, not like button up interview where I have seven questions I've got to ask you. And the thing when I started this podcast, it's always about conversations to me. It's not like, you know, this is where I'm going to be ranked on iTunes or this is, it's always about like, I have people who I'm fascinated with that I want to talk to. And I just want to have a chance to sit down and talk with them. And so, yeah, I don't know what most people experience in the interviews, and I don't listen to a ton of other people who interview guests that I'm going to have. So I don't know exactly what they experience because I want mine to be fresh. But yeah, it definitely is a high priority for me to make these questions.
Well, I told you need to, I don't know if you've done it, but you know, we talked about going kind of the Stephen Colbert route and just saying, but this is what to expect.
I'm
going to joke around a little bit. It's going to be loose. It's going to be boring.
I say that before everyone. And it's almost like redundant to say, your name is Sarcastic Lutheran on Twitter. Let me warn you, I might be a little bit sarcastic, but for most people, I try to say that, but
here's clearly where that comes from. Like, they don't know you.
Mm-hmm.
And when you don't know someone and you're doing an interview, you know, we talked about that at the top of the show about the internet controversies that yeah. I've been and other people. It's like, they really don't know who they're getting. And yeah. so like the walls are up. And that was really evident with one of my favorite people ever, Barbara Brown Taylor, is that when you interviewed her, like she thought she was still on MSNBC, you know, and she's talking to Luke Nordsworthy, which I like your interviews a whole lot better because they are much more personal.
Thank you, Sean. Thank you.
And so they have to kind of have this wall. And she talked about that, you know, the people who want to take selfies with her after.
Yeah, Nadia.
After she speaks at places. And I find the culture of Christian celebrity so ridiculous anyway, and we'll talk mm-hmm. about that in a minute. But then you have this touch point about CrossFit, and it's like, oh, like this is a real human. And you did it in a number of ways. And I have to do this when I'm speaking places. This idea of introducing yourself at multiple places of reference. So like, you know, I'm a church planner. I'm from CFC background. I do CrossFit. And so suddenly, like, you didn't become an interview. You became a friend, you know, and someone who understood her world and wasn't going to be about, well, you know, on page 52 of Pastrix, you said, so now explain how you do work about that, get about that theologically.
Yeah. I don't know if on MSNBC, someone's talking to her about how they think a wonderful pastor from Miami is an attractive man. I don't know if that's happening, but that happens there.
You know, Tulian, I was really hurt by that because I thought,
maybe you were in the running.
I thought I was the best looking pastor on Twitter. But,
outstanding. Okay. Let's go back to the selfie, the celebrity thing. What was fascinating to me is her talk about how much pressure gets put on her. And I think she referenced a piece from the Daily Beast that said, can Nadia save, you know, Christianity or liberal Christianity? And I thought, man, that is overwhelming. And you know what it reminded me of? I did an interview with Rich Franklin, who is a former UFC champion. I don't know if you know anything about the sport, but he talked about in his interview about how much pressure he feels on his shoulders because, you know, Rich Franklin, if you don't know who he is, he's former high school math teacher, well-educated guy, has a master's degree, in a lot of ways like this all-American guy that everyone looks up to. And they, people look to him and say, this is a role model. So we want you to win every night. And so when he's in front of 20,000 people who showed up to see him, who bought the ticket, who have the poster at home, he feels like he can't let them down. Yeah. And so this huge weight on his shoulders. And so Nadia, when she's talking about, she goes, you know, I have a lot of pressure and I'm wondering, that has just got to be oppressive. But also, like, how do people, you know, get to the point where they can say, you know what? People might think this of me. People might think I'm supposed to say Christianity. People might supposed to think I'm going to win at everything I do. But you know what? It's unrealistic. I can't do it, and I'm fine with it.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's the key is to say, you know, I can't handle all this. And what people don't realize about preaching, I think, and the celebrity that comes with preaching, is that there are, you know, I'm an introvert kind of line for preachers. But the truth is, preaching is an introvert's dream job in many ways, because most of the time, most of what you do is study and write. And you're doing that in solitary.
I know. Nadia says she spends 15 hours writing a sermon. And so there's only 10 minutes. And you do the same thing. I mean, the majority of time it's where no one's around.
Mm-hmm. And people are like, well, you're the assumption is because you're a preacher that you're really outgoing people person. And a lot of people are fit that. But the truth is, like, when you peel back what the job actually is, what the calling actually is, there's a lot of alone time in that. And that's why so many introverts are in it, because, oh, wait, I get to spend half of my work week by myself. And in a mode where people feel guilty for bothering me, if I'm
that's a pretty good deal. It's a pretty good deal
for an introvert. Just like, this is gold. But I, and she's like, it's very weird. Like I am nowhere near Nadia, right? But I mean, you've got the podcast. You know what it's like to be at places or be speaking places, and people say things to you because they know you, but you don't know them.
Yeah.
And it's so out of whack and it's very uncomfortable.
Yeah. I can't imagine for her, because that's the celebrity 101, is that you know about someone without actually knowing them.
Yes.
You know? So like, you know, the stage persona, which I don't mean that in a fake sense, but like when Seinfeld talks about when he goes on stage, like he's an exaggerated version of himself. And I think anytime you're on stage, you are having to be louder and a bigger version of who you are. And so people know about you, but they don't really know who you are.
Yeah.
And I have no comparison to what Nadia or Pastor Tullian or any of these real Christian celebrities have, it, but it's gotta be quite an onerous kind of thing walking around with that on your shoulders.
Oh yeah. And you know, some of that is just being, can Nadia save liberal Christianity? That's just a good headline to get people to read. Right.
Yeah.
And so there's part of it that you have to realize, you know, the newspaper web driving traffic too. And so to not take that on as, oh crap, now I have to save liberal Christianity.
Yeah. But you know, the thing that Franklin said is that he got rid of that once he lost his title. And once he lost, and then he faces the same guy in his, you know, two fights later to try to get his belt back, and he does not win that fight either, and it's not very pretty. And so sometimes when you fail, you realize, no, I can't, and it's okay, and you learn peace from it, and you can move forward once you accept that's not realistic, but you know what is realistic? I can make a difference, I can do my part, and trust that other people are going to do theirs as well.
Oh yeah. 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 And the what's interesting about the Christian celebrity business is like, we're just as bad as regular, you know, online, but I will be interested to see the arc. Cause we talked about Mark Driscoll at the beginning of what happens to Mark Driscoll now. Because in so many ways, whatever version of that was before is done.
It's never like,
that's
the same.
Over.
No.
I remember Brian, I'm tying all the threads together. I remember Brian saying to me years ago with the Catholic pedophilia scandal that this was an incredible opportunity for the Catholic Church to repent and become humble and to become God's people in a new way again. And then what do you see arise out of that? I mean, this new Pope who is, who is just beloved around the world because of that kind of humility and has taken on the pedophilia scandals. And so this might be what's true, what's not true, what's provable, what's not provable. This might be the best opportunity for ministry that Mark Driscoll has ever had.
And I hope that's the case. I definitely do. Yeah.
And so I think one of the things that people like about, Nadia is that, you know, it's not the tattoos, it's not the cursing. It is that they feel like they're not getting a pretend version.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Of whatever it is. And that's, you know, when she talked about the sentimentality in Christianity,
no.
I don't agree with her about anything as much as I agree with her about that. Just walk into a Christian bookstore, for goodness sake.
Did you notice that McLaren used the same word, the sentimentality of Christianity? Her example was the elk club with communion is what church is, or the Eucharist. McLaren said, you know, it's the big hair and all this, but they both were pushing back against that same sort of sentimentality, as they call it.
And I think for some of us, you know, Mike Cope wrote a couple years ago about spring and winter Christians. Mm-hmm. And I'm a winter Christian, and I think probably Nadia and Brian are too. And there's something about that that just rings really hollow to people like us, the always sunny, upbeat. But the thing is, I know there are people like that.
There are.
I mean, who are genuinely like that. Yeah. It just, to me, I'm just like, you know, okay.
Yeah.
but I don't think that she's probably resonating with those people. And I'm glad that the church is big enough and broad enough that there are people who, for whom, you know, Joel Osteen is memorable and moving. And that there are people for whom Nadia is memorable and moving.
Yeah.
Because Joel Osteen's message will never resonate with me, because that has just not been true to my reality in life. But when Nadia talks about, you know, and I've never, you know, been, what'd she say, puking out of her nose. I've never puked out of my nose, but I know plenty of people who have, and I know that that's probably a lot more common than that God's going to give you a triple scoop of ice cream day that I've heard Joel Osteen preach about.
Yeah. Well, we're definitely grateful for the voice that Nadia has, and we have gone by far. We're this like 30 minutes longer than any other podcast we've ever done. We're at 1:08 right now. So, Sean, thank you for being on a marathon July wrap-up podcast. Have to have you back again soon. But, hey, thanks for joining us while you're on vacation. You are a gentleman and a scholar. Thank you, Sean.
Thanks, Luke. Glad to be here.
Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norsworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You are now adjourned.